Indiana 2019 election results, the longest-serving Hoosier congressman is calling it quits, plus the Indianapolis Motor Speedway is sold, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending November 8th, 2019.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, both Republicans and Democrats had something to tout after Indiana's 2019 municipal elections. Both political parties could spin 2019 election results in their favor. Republicans can point to victories in mayor's races across the state. The GOP captured 70 such seats, the most ever, and money and volunteers often follow such victories. For Democrats, it's celebrating huge margins of victory in Indianapolis and Fort Wayne and surprising upsets in Hamilton County. Long a Republican stronghold, Democrats won races there they'd literally never won before, and that could have a ripple effect into next year's 5th congressional district race, where there are already 3 Democrats and 7 Republicans vying to replace retiring GOP incumbent Susan Brooks. What was the biggest takeaway from Election Night 2019? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Mike O'Brien, what stood out to you?
Kind of 3 things. One, I mean, obviously a historic night for Republicans statewide to pick up 70 mayor's offices, which goes into almost 90% of the local elected officials we have statewide already. So clearly a strong statewide footing there. But clear inroads for Democrats in the suburbs. I was Hendricks County GOP chairman. We elected not me, but Democrats and independents elected the first Democrat town council member in Avon, and having been county chairman, I could see that trend over time, and it was definitely trending that way as the demographics change and the opinions change of people and people in the suburbs and their party identification changes. What if you put those 2 things together, I think the 3rd thing was how strategies are changing statewide, how we elect statewide as Republicans, how we elect people statewide. When I first got into this, kind of during the Mitch Daniels first campaign, we had and then again in 08 and 12 and 16. We had a clear donut county strategy with the counties around Marion County. You really had to run the score up there. The rural areas, certainly southern Indiana back in 2004, was still pretty aligned with kind of conservative Democrats, guys like John Gregg and Frank O'Bannon, elected for Frank O'Bannon and Joe Kernan. But that has all changed. And Republicans right now, a year out, need to recognize that has changed, that we need that just because you're a Republican and your name's on the ballot in Hendricks or Hamilton County does not mean you're getting elected anymore. We have to pick candidates and recruit candidates that fit those districts. The 5th district is going to be the 5th congressional district is going to be the most urgent. If Democrats are smart, they've taken this outcome as evidence nationwide that they can go raise money and fuel it into that 5th district race. And so, you know, I'm not trying to bang on us I'm not trying to ignore the big upside for Republicans on a statewide basis, but we have to recognize where Democrats have made gains, understand why they have made those gains, and make sure that we plan accordingly as we're recruiting candidates and getting ready for 20.
What's to that to you?
Well, I mean, the problem is, can you recruit candidates that can appeal to that demographic anymore? I mean, when you take an absolute right-to-life position against any opportunity for choice, when you foster policies that aren't advantageous to women, when you're not for public education, all of those things together, it seems to me, is part of the reason the Democrats have been as successful as they have been in the donut counties. Now, they're not, it's not a landslide yet, but even more interesting from our perspective for the 5th district is the areas in Marion County, which had been traditionally held by Republican city council candidates, are now all in Democratic hands, which tells you that momentum, and that's in they're mostly in the 5th district as well.
Yeah, north of Indianapolis.
So it really makes a difference. And in the numbers, obviously, in terms of mayors and county elected officials go to the Republicans, but the population isn't there. The population sources, all the large cities went Democratic with the exception of Evansville, but they had gains for the Democrats on the Evansville City County Council, too. So, you know, in metropolitan areas,
that's a great example.
Areas,
like a guy like Lloyd Wineke is a perfect fit for Edmondson, right?
And he ought to be a Democrat opposed, because right? That's the way he thinks.
Well,
that's the way
he's
votes.
He's a pragmatic guy.
Well, that's why he's a Democrat. But but that's the only reason. I think his personality. If he doesn't run again, I think that seat's up for grabs.
We talk about how much we can read into, though, a local election for what it will mean for statewide elections next year. A lot of times these local races are decided on very local issues.
They are. And that's what I saw in everything is, you know, local elections are still about who picks up the trash and how are your streets and what your crime numbers are and things like that. I mean, we are not seeing, you know, things like impeachment and immigration and healthcare. You know, people are focusing on the local issues, the local candidates. And so that is still heartening to see that, you know, they're really looking at the issues that affect them on a daily basis when they make their choices.
Because in a lot of cases, more than anything else in local elections, a lot of times the people you're voting for are your literal neighbors.
Yes.
And the people you see at the grocery store and things like that.
The one thing about that, and the one thing that bothers me about the national polls, is we don't know. Everybody says that the Trump still has support of 90% of the Republicans. Nobody ever defines how big that universe is. And whether that universe is changing, and whether people who have self-identified before.
I've always wondered that. Yeah, I mean, is the population diluted? Like, I would understand that. I don't know who I'm talking to. If I as a Republican strategist don't understand that, what you just
said,
nobody, you as a Democrat.
Nobody
says
that.
I don't know how
that.
To talk to these people.
That's something I think everybody's kind of wrestling with. I started my piece by saying that both parties had something to tout. Is that the way you read these results, that everybody had something they could pull
this
out?
This is the quintessential ink blot that, you know, test. We can all sit there and look at it. You can see one thing. You can see something. You can see something. And everybody's right, to be flippant here. I generally...
That's the John Swanis thing I've ever heard.
Thank you.
I think everybody's right.
I read that in Dale Carnegie. We're going to win friends and influence people. But, I mean, I subscribe to the notion that Nikki put forth that generally you can't discern any overarching trends from local races because, again, I had a bad experience with that insurance agency, which is run by the guy who's running for that seat, or my kid's teacher.
I don't think we can predict that Delaware County is going to go to Republicans next year because they elected a Republican mayor of Muncie. There were some other things going on.
There
in
were
Muncie.
A lot of other things going on.
The one indicator you can point to in that is straight party voting and whether or not, because in Hendricks County, back when I was chair for 8 years, people would, you know, the pragmatic Republican or whatever, the Republican that should have won didn't win in the primary, for example, but most people wanted to win, didn't win for whatever reason. And they'd have an independent run that was kind of like-minded. There was no chance because the straight ticket was just too heavy. And people weren't being thoughtful. They weren't looking, and they were just hitting the button and leaving.
And that's where it does
because they were
down,
just so, they were so, like,
well, then we should all subscribe to Mike Pence.
They were so loyal to the party forever.
Let's look at the race nationally. They got the most attention briefly this week. Kentucky. If you look at a map of where you have the familiar reds and blues, basically it looks like how did a Democrat win this state on a statewide race? Because it's entirely red. But guess what? Those blue splotches, which happen
don't
to be
don't have
Louisville.
Many people.
Well,
no,
the blues do have a lot.
I
have not seen somebody do the analysis yet on Indiana, but clearly it's going to be Kentucky-esque in terms of a sea of red, in terms of the relatively sparsely populated areas versus those very blue population centers.
Well, 4 of the 10 school districts with measures on the ballot this week failed to receive voter approval for school funding tax increases. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay reports.
Two districts that lost proposed both construction and operations measures. Danville Community Schools was one of them. Superintendent Tracy Schaefer says now it's time to figure out next steps to keep more teachers, repair buildings, and improve busing.
And we have a need to replace 17-year-old buses so they're safe for our children.
Meanwhile, Hamilton Community School Corporation Superintendent Tony Castle says with his district's referendum win, he's ready to get back to doing his job.
A lot of tears with parents tonight, with my wife, staff members, just, you know, rejoicing that we're moving forward.
And Delaney, of the 13 total questions in the 10 districts, only 7 were approved, so 6 were obviously denied. Are we starting to see voter fatigue with school referenda?
I think what you're starting to see is a sense of frustration. When Mitch Daniels put the property tax caps in,
and the voters put them in the Constitution,
the General Assembly and the governor said they were going to fund education, and they haven't done it. They haven't done it. Our teachers' pay is at the bottom of the national levels and on and on and on. And I think what you're seeing is the rubber hitting the road here. With a $2 billion surplus, and we're studying the issue of teacher raises for 2 years, I mean, we have teachers leaving in droves. And you can't blame them. It's a tough job, and we're paying them less than they're making at Amazon stocking boxes. So we need to do something, and the state legislature and the governor need to step forward and do it now. Not a year or 2 years from now, but now.
This kind of gets back to what I just talked about with how much can you read into a local election about trends. With school referenda, are these a lot of times just you don't know what's going on in that specific district, and that's why they said yes or no, and so it's hard to read into the broader trend?
Yeah, well, first, the governor and the legislature did do something. They put $750 million in new money in K-12 education this year. You love to use the surplus as this kind of, you know, straw man. But it's one time. So you take two. So let's say that we're going to take every dollar and put it in teacher pay. So now there's $2 billion available for teacher pay. What do we do next year?
We stop the corporate tax phase out. That's what we do.
Okay. Full
Very
circle.
Simple. Very simple.
You really walked right into that one.
I did. You
opened the door
to that one.
It's been weeks since you said it. But I've been around a lot of these referenda, including communities where they were done once and then redone, and there are just varying degrees of sophistication and communities and school corporations' ability to run these, and they are really local. These cases are made in American Legion halls, and they are really. And you've got to build a case. And so in Avon, we did it once and it failed, and we did it a second time, and it was a much better campaign. It was much more engaged in the community with voters, and it passed the second time because they clearly made the case, even though we have these beautiful school buildings.
We saw an example of that this year in a race that you looked at on Tuesday.
Yeah, in Hamilton up in Northeast Indiana, they had one last year, and it was to renew an existing renewal, but then they added a little bit on top, and the community said no. Partly due to some misinformation, they thought they were going to do the existing plus a whole new thing. So basically, they scaled back and said, we just want to renew the current operating levy we have, and the people came out to do it. Now, I do want to note that going back to 2000, or I think whenever they went in, 05 or something, or 9, they've passed 62% of the time. So we're pretty online.
Yeah, but
it's still basically unfair, because when you have school districts that are poor have to raise the tax rate substantially more than they do in Hamilton County, and they get less money for that because the base is the property tax values. And so it is disproportionately affecting those districts that need the money the most. And that's what's unfair about the state
one takeaway is
stepping up to the bar.
The more clearly defined you can make the target cause. It reminds me of somebody who's raising money for, you know, a charity or a school, and if you say, just, we're a good cause, write us a check.
Fund our endowment. That's
one thing.
That's
versus
really fatal.
We have a desperate need for this building or this particular scholarship or whatever the case might be. Yeah. I think it's always easier. So you look, for instance, at Carmel Clay Schools, just north of Indianapolis here, which was the first to use a new tool that was given to them by lawmakers in this past session of the General Assembly, which was a referendum tied specifically to safety.
School safety. Right.
School safety. And the superintendent there, for instance, said what a game changer it was. Now, maybe it would have passed anyway. That's a district that historically funds education at the highest level. But when people said, oh, well, would this go to some other purpose than beefing up security? He could say, by law, it can't. Yeah. It's clearly going to be this.
Very
and I
targeted.
Think that to the extent that people can find ways to make that argument and really clearly define it, that's where the success may reside.
Well, the Indianapolis Motor Speedway will soon be under new ownership. Holman & Company announced Monday it entered into an agreement with Penske Corporation to sell the company's operating assets, including the racetrack, the IndyCar series, and IMS Productions. Roger Penske says attending the 1951 Indianapolis 500 with his father sparked his interest in racing. He's since won 18 Indy 500s as a team owner and will soon be the fourth owner of the iconic racetrack.
I've got a big commitment here to take over, certainly as the steward of this great organization and what's been done here in the past for so many decades. And, you know, it's my commitment to the Holman family.
Financial details of the agreement have not been made public. The sale is expected to be completed in January. Vicki Kelly, obviously for sports fans, this is a, and racing fans, this is a big deal. But how big is this a deal for the Speedway and Indiana in general?
I think it's a pretty big deal. Obviously, seeing the Holman George family step away is a tradition that some people are really going to miss. But I think people are excited for what, you know, the Penske name can bring to it. I don't think I would expect sort of major changes, but they're already looking at things like adding a 24-hour race or maybe look for a NASCAR IRL doubleheader weekend. I mean, I see them trying to build on it and not necessarily, you know, try to reinvent the wheel, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to think. I mean, the fact that it's in Roger Penske's hands, this is not exactly a new name to Indiana racing, despite the fact that he's not from Indiana. You got to feel pretty good about the hands it's being put into.
Oh, I think so. I mean, that's the gold standard, if you will. If you look at the number of championships won, both series championships and the number of championships in the Indianapolis 500 specifically. Yeah. Unparalleled, clearly. And here's somebody who knows, by all accounts, look at any number of spreadsheets that will tell you this is a guy who knows how to run a business successfully and expand properly. Motorsports, it seems to me, at every level, whether you're talking about NASCAR, whether you're talking about open-wheel racing, is undergoing, it's being forced to undergo dramatic changes because of the way it's merchandised, the way it's consumed in terms of different media platforms. And there had been sort of a lack over the years at all levels, again, of the willingness capability to change, with fans and with demographics and market trends. And one thing I think Roger Penske will do well is make sure that it's calibrated properly.
That's two for two. not a lot of pressure on you, Mike. Yeah.
Sure.
And again, this is more than just about a single race, or even the racing, and this is economic development for Indiana. This is a big impact on Indiana's economy.
Oh yeah, drive down 136 or Northfield Drive in Brownsburg and see all the race teams there, and drive down Main Street and Speedway, and how that's been redeveloped over the last several years. I mean, this is a momentum boost. If they add more races, that's awesome. As a race fan. And it's great that, you know, I'm not sure if it's great for the other team. No one asked the other teams what they thought of Roger Penske.
That's true. That's got to be a little worrying for them. I think the biggest thing about this to me, beyond the sale itself, was this came out of nowhere.
Oh, you really have to admire their ability to keep these negotiations secret, boy. It was. I picked up the paper and said, "Whoa, where had I been that this had happened and I didn't even know?" But I think the observations are correct. He can take it, you know, to the starting line and over the finish line.
Man, I'm just mad, man.
All right, time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question: is Roger Penske buying the IndyCar Series and the Indianapolis Motor Speedway a good thing? A yes or B no. Last week's question: should college athletes be allowed to profit off their name, image, and likeness? 64% of you say yes, 36% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, U.S. Representative Pete Visklosky, the longest-serving member of Congress in Indiana history, announced he will not seek re-election in 2020. The Northwest Indiana Democrat has served as the representative for Indiana's 1st Congressional District for 35 years. In the statement announcing his retirement, Visklosky didn't give a reason why, but did highlight some of his work to build support for organized labor and invest in the region. He also says there's still work to be done for the area. Visklosky won his 2018 re-election by more than 30 percentage points over his Republican challenger.
John Schwanis, there's already three people expressing at least some level of interest in the seat on the Democratic side. How wild will its primary get?
It really doesn't matter who's expressing interest on the Republican side.
Not as much.
Which is why this is one of those rare opportunities that is guaranteed to elicit a long list of candidates, far longer than the three who are out there now. You look back in history, this district as it's constituted now, which is, you know, this portion of the state, which is so heavily Democratic, has been around basically since the early 30s. Since that time, you have, I think, five people have held the seat. And if you take out a guy who, you know, one person died in office and then the caretaker who was appointed to take that, basically you have three and a half people who have done it since the Depression, all Democrats, of course. So if there is anything in modern American politics, it's close to a lifetime appointment. This is what it is.
Remarkable up for life. Everyone went to prison, given that they're from Lake County.
I'm from Lake County. The Garing Council president was just arrested again.
So when you have an opportunity like this, and you are a Democrat, again, I don't think we need to worry much. I don't see any chance that this would flip in any way. You are going to have a vigorous campaign for that.
Now, Eddie Melton beat me to the punch because I was going to ask you. Eddie Melton is running for governor, but that's got to look pretty. It's got to look pretty appealing. But he came out now and he said that he's sticking in the race for governor. Do you think that's the right call for him?
I think it probably is. I think he's become an interesting candidate to a lot of people on the Democrat side for the governor's race. So I think it's probably a good deal. I think from a journalistic standpoint, when you put him and Mayor Tom McDermott out there, I mean, it's going to be fun to cover because you never know what you'll get from him.
I mean, obviously, this is about as sure thing as you get for the Democrats. So in that sense, can the primary get as wild as it wants to be?
Oh, absolutely, because it will determine the election, as some districts for the Republicans do. So, yeah, I expect that there'll be a lot of serious candidates in there for that, because Pete Viskovsky's had that seat for 30 years and been focused like a laser on Northwest Indiana, and whoever his successor is will be there for a long time as well.
I read a piece in the Times of Northwest Indiana today, though, that said that Republicans up there are trying to find a more serious candidate to run. It's an open seat. They know they probably don't have much of a chance, but looking at somebody like John Casas, who just left the Valparaiso mayor's office, is there an argument to trying to actually mount a more serious campaign for that?
Yeah, maybe. We'll see who the Democrats nominate. I mean, if they do have a long list and it's a mess, and like Tom McDermott is like, he's not exactly America's mayor, but he's kind of like the Democrats' Donald Trump. So, I mean, there's always a chance that
you nominate the wrong guy. Thank the Lord.
All right. Does removing a GPS tracker from your car, even if police put it there, mean you stole it? That's what the state argued in a case heard this week by the Indiana Supreme Court. Warwick County Sheriff's officers got a warrant last year to put a GPS tracker on Derek Hearing's car because they thought he was a drug dealer. After a while, the tracker stopped transmitting, and when police went to replace it, they couldn't find it on the car. So officers got a search warrant by arguing Hearing stole the tracker. And when serving that warrant, they found drugs on his property and arrested him. But Indiana's Supreme Court justices, including Mark Massa, were skeptical of the state's argument.
Even if you know it's the police that are tracking you, you have an obligation to leave it there and let them track you. And if you take it off, you're then somehow subject to a search of your home.
There's no timetable for the Supreme Court's ruling. Andalini, is the state trying to stretch a little too far
here? Oh, my gosh. I mean, I read this fact situation and said, what are they thinking? What was that sheriff thinking down there in Warwick County? I mean,
he was thinking he got a judge to agree to it.
Well, the problem is, okay, they put the tracker on, all right, and the tracker's no longer on. How do they know he stole it? How do they know he didn't hit a bump and have it fall off or go to a car wash and have it washed off? I mean, the idea that you could then bootstrap on to an arrest warrant and a search warrant, go in, find the drugs, and get them on both. Yeah, I'd be really surprised if this conviction were upheld.
Mark Massa, the justice who we quoted in the piece, at the very end of the argument when the attorney for this guy came up for his rebuttal said, you know, we just jumped up and down on the state's attorney here for a little while, but tell me why I'm not just giving a green light to every drug dealer in the state to take the tracker and throw it in the river. Is that an oversimplification, or is that like they have to try and find some sort of balance here too?
They're going to try to find a balance, but Mark Massa is also a pretty pro-law enforcement guy, and he was skeptical in the quote that... If the only thing you can make the case on is that he stole the GPS, then it's either bad police work or bad, you know, it's just a bad. You couldn't build the case, so you had to get creative. Yeah.
There is no middle ground. Okay, they're going to lose those trackers. Whether also, they go in the river or not.
Massa also kind of asked a broader point and briefly, John, which was how much do we have to cooperate with the police surveilling us?
Well, that's to me is a fundamental question, and it's going to become more profound as technology continues to expand in ways that we can't imagine now. So there are a lot of questions, Fifth Amendment questions and others, that will have to be resolved.
They better go back to surveillance.
All right. Well, finally, Republicans flipped the Kokomo mayor's seat this week as Tyler Moore defeated Abby Smith. Mike O'Brien, can Mayor Tyler Moore turn the world on with his smile?
Oh, my God.
He's going to make it after all, but Mike stole that. I stole my line and put it in the tagline there.
Oh, there we go.
Too bad it's not in
but Brent. But he beat a woman, which is completely counter to that.
This is the opposite. Like
the voters
of Kokomo.
Do you know how many people
out there will know this reference?
I'm right on the edge. I'm literally right on the edge. It was on when I was a
Kokomo
kid.
If Kokomo were in Grant County, that would be even better.
That stretches our audience.
Yeah. Let's see how.
I'll be honest with you. After I saw that the person who was running for mayor and mayor of any office was Tyler Moore, and I put it together in my head, I was going to talk about this whether he won or lost. So it was just an excuse for me
just
to get.
Couldn't help it.
The joke works both ways.
Yeah, it absolutely was. Either we were deprived of Mayor Tyler Moore or not. That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.